Good evening. If you would, go ahead and open up your Bibles to Jeremiah chapter 35. It'll take us a little while before we get there, but we will get there. Jeremiah 35. I'll say hello for the church in, up in Pinson. I'm sure Bob would say the same. It's one of the most wonderful blessings about getting into preaching is being able to go to different places, being able to meet with different churches, and the immediate connection, the immediate bond that you have just by setting foot in the building is a wonderful thing, and I'm thankful to have been there this morning. So something that I believe makes the Bible truly divine, and what I mean by that is truly God's inspired word, is the little mini stories that are weaved within the larger narrative of the Bible. The story of Ruth, I think, is a pretty interesting story just by itself, right? You can see how that fits within the larger narrative of just Judges, perhaps. You can then go down a little bit deeper and you can see, whoa, here's how Ruth fits in the story of Jesus. And then you can unpack, well, the history of the Moabites, which is the nationality of Ruth. And man, well, that adds even more details to the story. And the story becomes more and more rich as you dive into it. I think these mini stories give credence to the notion that the Bible, even though it is made up of a lot of different books, written by a lot of different authors over thousands of years, it's still telling a unified story, a story that gives us a complete picture of God, a story that tells us about who we are and how we have severed that relationship between God and man. But it also tells us this story about the Messiah who came to bring us together, that being Jesus. Well, I want to discuss one of these many stories throughout the Bible here this evening through a group of people called the Rechabites. They get a special highlight in Jeremiah chapter 35, but really you see them throughout the Bible. They're constantly playing like this supporting role, almost like a footnote in this story. And yet throughout, you notice, well, they're not Israelites, and that's a key thing to keep in mind as we go throughout this lesson, but they are still playing a considerable role for God and God's people. And the way I want to do this is I want to do it with a timeline. We'll be going through this particular timeline, checking out the history of these people. And the beginning would go all the way back, really, to the book of Genesis. We see them first in Genesis chapter 15 in Canaan in about 2000 BC or so. However, they're not called Rechabites there. They're actually called Kenites, and I'll make that connection here in a minute, but this is something that God says to Moses, you're going to go into this land and here's some people that are going to be there, and among the list are the Kenites. Now there's a similar list that's given later on in the story when you get to Exodus chapter 23, so we're pretty far ahead here, except in this story, God is telling them you're going to enter into this land, but these people are going to be cut off. They're going to be cast out of this land. But you notice a group of people that are not among the list, and that is the Kenites. So here are these Kenites who were back with Abraham in Genesis 15. They're in that land, but then when the similar list is given later, they're not among the list. Now we'll make a connection with that. I think there's an explanation there as you get into a little more into the timeline, as you look into Jethro and Moses. They come up again in the story of Jethro. Earlier in Exodus chapter 2, you'll remember Moses kills this Egyptian. He's not accepted by the Hebrews, rejected by them. He has to run away to this region of Midian. And while he's in Midian, he meets some people who are living in Midian, not necessarily Midianites, but people who are living in that particular region, and he marries Zipporah, the daughter of a priest named Jethro. Now, Jethro gets a little confusing because he goes by two other names in Scripture, Reuel and Hobab. We'll get into that in just a minute, but he meets Jethro. He develops this relationship with his father-in-law, and he is called the priest of Midian. How was Jethro a priest? It doesn't really get into detail there, right? When we think of a priest, we think of it in terms of a priest to God. Was he a priest to the God, Yahweh God, or was he just a priest to maybe one of the other gods? Really, I'm not sure it matters, because what we see later on when we see Jethro again in Exodus chapter 18, you'll remember at this point in the story, God has delivered his people through the Red Sea. And after that, Moses meets up with his father-in-law, Jethro, again. And here's what Jethro says. When he has seen and heard of this story, Jethro said, "Now I know that the Lord is greater." Whatever he was before, he seems to be converted now. He worships Yahweh. He worships the God of Israel. And then he kind of joins in. Him and his family joins in with the people of Israel. And we come across Jethro again in Numbers chapter 10. Now, in Numbers chapter 10, Moses is speaking to his father-in-law. And he's like trying to get Jethro and his family to come with him. Hey, come with us into this promised land. Now, I skipped over it in the text, and I shouldn't have, but I already turned in the PowerPoint. Anyway, verse 30, it indicates how Jethro is kind of reluctant to go into this promised land. He recognizes that he is not one of God's chosen people, and this is a land that's for God's chosen people. So he shows some reluctance, but Moses is like, no, you got to come with us. He says in verse 31, he said, "Please do not leave us, inasmuch as you know where we should camp in the wilderness." Like, these are pretty good campers, and apparently they're helpful for the Israelites in teaching them how to use tents and move about and things along those lines. Now, tuck that in the back of your mind as well. That's going to play a role as we move forward. So here is Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, who is going along with God's people. And when you get into Judges 1, they eventually go into the land. And here's where the connection is to this group of people that we're talking about this morning. The descendants of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law. So Jethro is a Kenite. That's going to play, I think, a pretty significant role. But you see, over time, this group that lived with Abraham, maybe they learned a thing or two about camping back with Abraham. Abraham knew how to move from one place to another. He's converted to the God down in Midian, and then he partners with God's people, helping them back into the promised land. Pretty interesting. But the story continues. We see the Kenites again, but this time in Judges chapter 4. Now, Judges' timeline is a pretty difficult one to follow, but the Kenites are mentioned again here in the story of Jael. Now, that story is always fun to tell. In Judges chapter 4, you'll remember Deborah is a judge at that time, and she prophesied that there would be this woman who would defeat Sisera, Sisera being the commander of the Canaanite king's army. This woman is going to defeat Sisera. And in Judges chapter 4 and verse 11, we're told of Heber the Kenite, who lives in that particular region. But we don't really care about Heber. We care about his wife, who is Jael, and she is living in that region. As the story continues, Sisera has to run away because his army's been defeated by Barak, and he goes into the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. And y'all know this story, I think. You know, she makes Sisera nice and comfortable, gives him a bed, gives him some blankets and stuff like that, wait until he's fast asleep, and then bang, puts a tent peg through his temple, right? Now, a tent peg, right? Something that she's pretty well familiar with, being a group of people who are constantly going from one place to another and doing things like that. So, just another tidbit about how these Kenite people are aiding God's people one way or another. And the way these Kenite people, these non-Israelites, are being used by God. All right, keep with me here. Fast forward another 100 years or so, and you get to David. And in 1 Samuel chapter 30, the Amalekites are defeated, and now the spoils of the Amalekites are being dished out to different people in Israel and stuff like that. But among the receivers of these spoils are the Kenites. They are given a portion. Well, why would that be? Why would they be given a portion of this wealth? Well, if you go back to 1 Samuel chapter 15, you go to the time of Saul. Saul is speaking to the Kenites. Hey, I'm going to go defeat the Amalekites. I want y'all to get away from their region. I want y'all spared. I don't want to defeat y'all, for you showed kindness to all the sons of Israel. All right, so here's this non-Israelite group yet again being recognized for the way in which they are aiding God's people. Well, then, You can go a little further into 1 Chronicles chapter 2. I know we all read 1 Chronicles 1 through 9 all the time in this long list of genealogies, right? Well, buried in the middle of those genealogies are the Kenites again. But you'll notice here in chapter 2, verse 55, it says the family of scribes. So now here's this group of people who are aiding God's people in a way of being scribes. They're rewriting the word. They're writing it down, preserving the word. But here's the connection to the group of people that we're really talking about this morning. Highlighted on the screen, those are the Kenites who came from Hamath, the father of the house of Rechab. All right, so somewhere along the line, they decided to stop calling them Kenites, and now they are Rechabites. Same people, though, that we're talking about. They're playing this role of scribes. So we're like 500 years plus into this history of God's people, and this non-Israelite people are still at peace with God's people, and there's still this valuable addition to the land. But you skip forward another couple hundred years, stick with me here. We go to 2 Kings chapter 10, and we get the story of Jonadab, or Jehonadab, he's called both names, in 2 Kings chapter 10. But we gotta scoot back a little bit, because you remember in 2 Kings 9, Jehu is appointed king in Israel. Elisha is told to appoint Jehu as king, but he's going to be given a task. Jehu is supposed to go kill all the household of Ahab, because Ahab is terrible. Ahab and Jezebel have caused Baal worship throughout God's people, and that needs to be eradicated. So we're going to make sure that the entire group of people are done with. Jehu, you're going to take that on. And so he does that. He's rather successful in his efforts, but as he continues, you pick up in 2 Kings 10 in verse 15, now, when Jehu had departed from there, he met Jehonadab, the son of Rechab. So he meets up with this non-Israelite. He pretty much asked him, if I might summarize what's on the screen, hey, you want to come with me? Here's what I'm doing. And Jehonadab is like, yeah, I'll come with. And they go and they defeat Baal worship in all the region. What a wonderful story. He picks up a non-Israelite to complete this task. What's so interesting about this is that most of Israel at this point had been led away from God because of the works of Ahab and Jezebel. And yet, here's this non-Israelite, Canaanite, Rechabite person who somehow maintained his faith. After all, it's a faith that had been established hundreds of years ago, a faith that was established really at the same time that the Israelite faith had been established. And yet, this person was able to maintain his faith while most of Israel had been taken away. Why is that? Why had he not fallen into the same trap that everyone else had fallen into? Let's keep that in mind. And let's zoom forward another 200 years, and that's where we get to the text that I want to look at this afternoon. When we get to Jeremiah chapter 35. Now, at this point, this is during the Judah alone period. Even though we just talked about the great things that Jehu had done for the nation of Israel, 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 31 says that Jehu was not careful to walk in the law of the Lord. He eventually just goes the same way everybody else went, and then Assyria takes over Israel, and they're taken off into captivity. And as for Judah, well, their day is not too far away. In this very chapter in Jeremiah 35, it talks about Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah. He didn't follow in the footsteps of Josiah. And Nebuchadnezzar is pretty much knocking at the door, ready to take over. So that kind of sets the cultural backdrop that we see here in Jeremiah 35. Let's read beginning in verse 1. The word which came to Jeremiah from the Lord in the days of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, saying, go to the house of the Rechabites and speak to them and bring them into the house of the Lord, into one of the chambers, and give them wine to drink. So with this crowd of God's people summoned, he gets the Rechabites to bring them in, and then he starts to speak to these people. We see in these next few verses, he actually shows great generosity to the Rechabites. If you look at verse 5, this is during a time of really great need for those in Judah. There's a time of great shortage in the land, and yet look what he's doing. Then I set before the men of the house of the Rechabites pitchers full of wine and cups, and I said, drink them. So during this time of really not having a whole lot, they give pitchers upon pitchers to these Rechabites and commands them to drink. But we'll see in the next verse that they refuse. Now I'll pause. I'll pause and say this. It's interesting. People use this verse to defend the drinking of alcohol, saying that, hey, Jeremiah recommends it. But then people use the same exact verse to condemn the drinking of alcohol by saying, well, the Rechabites don't do it. I'm here to tell you that this verse is not to defend either one of those positions. All right? That's not what this is here for. I think there's a much greater lesson that is being taught. So the Rechabites refuse. But in verse 6, listen to what they say. It says, we will not drink wine. For Jonadab, the son of Rechab, our father, commanded us, saying, you shall not drink wine, you or your sons, forever. So with no hesitation, no indecision, with a prepared statement of sorts, maybe it's something they have said before, the Rechabites refused the generosity of Jeremiah. But why? Why did they choose not to do it? Well, it's because their great, great, however many great grandfather said, hey, you shouldn't do this. That's it. It's not like they had some special command from God or anything like that. Somebody way back when told them not to do it. This non-Israelite gave them this instruction, and then 200 years later, here they are obeying it. But there is more to it. It wasn't just about the wine. Look at verse 7. Look at what else they're doing. You shall not build a house. You shall not sow a seed. And you shall not plant a vineyard or of your own. But in tents you shall dwell all your days. So they're not allowed to drink wine. They're not allowed to make a farm, a vineyard, or build a house. They got to stay in tents all their days. And yet they've been doing it for 200 plus years. They've been doing it. And notice what I have highlighted in blue on the screen there. Notice they point out it's because they were sojourners. That's what they need to remember. So this goes way back, even before Jonadab. They knew that they were not the people of promise. And also, notice the language here. It should sound pretty familiar, right? They were obedient to their father and mother, I'll add parenthetically, and because of that, they would live long in the land. Does that sound familiar to you at all? Exodus chapter 20, verse 12, honor your father and mother that your days may be prolonged in the land. You think Jethro would have heard something like that? I think so. Do you think something like that would have been passed down to their families, even though they're non-Israelites? I think so. And so here is Jonadab saying, you're going to honor your father and mother. And they did it. So here's this group of people. They don't drink. They don't have houses. They just live in tents everywhere they go. They won't even make like good money for themselves. They don't have farms or vineyards or anything like that. What do you think the people of Judah thought of these weirdos? What do you think they would have thought of them? If I were to compare them to anybody at this time, maybe a modern day example, maybe they'd be like the Amish, right? Okay, so there's this group of people that clearly live differently than everybody else. They look different than everybody else. They don't make money the same way everybody else does. They ride in horse and buggies, and if you don't think that's strange, man, if your children drive by something like that, they point and say, look at that, right? Like, this is different. They live differently. Now, Jeremiah brings in the Rechabites for a purpose. He wants to make a point out of this. Was that point to show God's people, hey, look at these non-Israelites, and yet they are more obedient to the law than you are? No, that's not it. Because not only did the law permit these things, but the land, this permanent dwelling that was given to God's people, was given to them so they would build houses there. It was given to them so they would have farms and vineyards and make money off of it. God wanted them to have the wealth of the land, and yet the Rechabites choose to do something totally different. So it's not that. Was Jeremiah, did he see like a drinking problem in the land? And he, you know, we got to get to the bottom of this. And hey, here's a group of people who don't do that. Look at them. No, that's not it either. Did the Rechabites take this opportunity to rebuke the people of Judah and say, hey, you all need to be more like us? No, that doesn't happen either. Maybe. Maybe Jeremiah brings these people to make the simple point of, these people are obedient. You are not. Could that be it? I mean, let's back up a little bit. Why do you think Jonadab made commands like this? Why do you think Jonadab gave these particular commandments? Because they're not found in the law. He's one who fears God, and yet he's going a little beyond, right? So why does he do something like this? Maybe part of it was just to protect their long-lasting family tradition or heritage. I mean, after all, Jethro, way back when, was like the camping expert, and so maybe they just wanted to keep that idea going. Hey, living in tents is a part of our heritage. Let's pass that down. Maybe that's a part of it. Maybe these traditions were really just to reinforce that they were not the children of promise. You remember Jethro's reluctance back in Numbers chapter 10. Their faith in God was such that they were not the anointed ones. They were not the children of promise, and they were jealous of the Israelites for that. They knew their place. And so maybe Jonadab has this particular law for his people so that that will be maintained and that will be remembered. Maybe that's it. Or maybe more significantly, they wanted to avoid the temptations that the Israelites had clearly succumbed to. Deuteronomy chapter 8 points this out pretty well. It's a warning that Moses gives to God's people. When you have eaten and are satisfied, you shall bless the Lord. Remember that God is the one who has given you these things. Otherwise, you may say in your heart, my power and the strength of my hand made me this wealth. You think Jonadab would have seen that? Yeah, perhaps the Kenites heard this and they took it to heart. And as a way of keeping them from their own pride, they're like, hey, we're not going to build houses, even though we have the right to do so. And you know what? We're not going to plant vineyards or have farms, even though we have the right to do so. We're not going to give ourselves up to these attractive worldly pleasures, even though we have the right to do so. We're not going to fall the same way that they have. But I would suggest, most significantly, that Jonadab wanted to protect his family from the dangers of the culture around him, particularly the consequences that come from following that way of living. I mean, consider what Jonadab would have seen to this point. I mean, he's around during the time of Ahab and Jezebel, or at least shortly after. He's seen the influence of them on God's people. He also saw God's punishment on them, even participated in it, right? And so he's seen those things. He saw the rise of Jehu, but he also saw his demise, and he saw how he didn't follow God. And in the south, it wasn't much better. Perhaps Jonadab and the other Rechabites would have heard of the idol worship, the intrigue, the assassinations, the backstabbing, all that stuff. I feel like it's a pretty reasonable conclusion that Jonadab saw all of this, and he said to himself and to his family, hey, look, we're not going to do that. And you know what? Beyond that, we're not going to even come close to doing that. I've seen where this can lead. I have seen God's punishment, and I fear God, and because of that, we're not going to come close to doing that. We might have the right to do some of these things, but we are not going to do it. And look at the point that Jeremiah wants to bring out for them, beginning in verse 13. Kind of halfway there in verse 13, he says, "Will you not receive instruction by listening to my words, declares the Lord? The words of Jonadab, the son of Rechab, which he commanded his sons not to drink wine, are observed. And so they do not drink wine to this day, for they have obeyed their father's command. But I have spoken to you again and again, yet you have not listened to me. I've sent you all my servants, the prophets, sending them again and again, saying, turn now every man from his evil way and amend your deeds, and do not go after other gods to worship them. Then you will dwell in the land. I'm going to give you this great thing if you do this. But you have not inclined your ear or listened to me. Indeed, the sons of Jonadab, the son of Rechab, have observed the command of their father, which he commanded them. But this people has not listened to me." Look at what Jeremiah does here. He kind of sets up this side-by-side comparison of what Jonadab told his people to do and what God has told you to do. God has given you a law that's actually less strict than what Jonadab has given his people, and yet they're obedient. God, being the creator, the sustainer of the world, the embodiment of wisdom, he's the one who's given you this law. Yet Jonadab's just some guy giving you man's wisdom. God has given his prophets again and again and again to reinforce this word, to give you inspiration, to give you hope, to give you something to look to. And yet Jonadab just kind of said his thing once, 200 plus years ago, and it's just this oral tradition that is kept up. God even provided reward for those who would follow his command and punishment if you decided to go another direction. Jonadab couldn't do anything like that. He didn't provide anything like that. So how is it that the sons of Jonadab observed his command, but this people has not listened to me? Well, what can we gather from a story like this? What can we learn from Jeremiah chapter 35? Well, Jeremiah brought up these people for the purpose of others learning from them. So let's see what we can find. Let's put ourselves in the perspective of the people of Judah. I'll ask this: are we motivated to obey God as others are motivated to obey the traditions of men? For instance, are we motivated by the zeal of people who knock on our doors and give us Watchtower magazines? Are we motivated by their enthusiasm for evangelism? Are we motivated by the fact that they have had door after door after door shut in their face, and yet they just keep doing it? They're on street corners downtown. Are we motivated by that type of zeal, or do we say to ourselves, well, God never told us to do that? I mean, they're just following some tradition of men. We don't have to do that. Are we motivated by young people who go to these distant places for years at a time proclaiming the gospel of Joseph Smith? I mean, these people are going house to house. They're like dressed up. They're riding on bikes. They look pretty different than everybody else. And yet they're going house to house, apartment to apartment, village to village in some places. They're mocked. They're ridiculed. And yet they do it. And they're doing it for some tradition of man. Well, let's take it out of the religious realm. Are we motivated by people who march for civil rights? Because they see something so great about this achievement that they're going to get together in inconvenient times, put themselves in dangerous spots, all for the sake of some human, worldly achievement? Are we motivated by people who donate huge amounts of money to political campaigns? You see the amount of sacrifice that they have for some politician. Are we motivated by people who read and reread and research as much as they possibly can to find a cure to a disease? I'm not trying to minimize any of these things, but are we motivated by the enthusiasm that takes that the next step? Again, we're putting ourselves in the shoes of Judah. We're looking at these Rechabites, these like olden day Amish people, and we're trying to look at them and see what can we learn from this. But let's look at more godly examples. Are we motivated by godly examples of men and women who are doing certain things here in this audience? Are we motivated by our elders who have been selected, these godly men who have our best interests at heart? And when they enact certain things or give us advice on how to handle maybe a pandemic or something, are we submissive to things like that? Or maybe they make some recommendations on like moral behavior, like maybe you shouldn't drink or something like that. Or do we just throw up our hands? Well, those are just guys. Those are just men. I think we need to be thoughtful of these things. Well, let's take the Amish from before. They dress differently. They live differently. Do they do that because the Bible tells them they have to do that? No. Because some religious guys way back when said, hey, this would be a good thing to do. And yet for hundreds of years, they've been obedient to that. I'm not saying we should start living in Amish communities, all right? That's not what I'm suggesting. I'm not even saying we ought to dress the same way. All I'm suggesting is we ought to look at peculiar people who are doing peculiar things and ask ourselves, do we have that same enthusiasm for God? Do we have that same drive, but not for worldly things or traditions of men, but for the God above? Two things I think we should consider, and that is, we can obey God's word. Because you know what? There are people who are doing harder things for less incentive. We can obey God's word, and we can certainly do more than what we're doing now. But I think something else we can learn from this is really from the perspective of the Rechabites. I think if we look at the perspective of the Rechabites, I think we can learn quite a bit. If you look at the end of Jeremiah chapter 35, God acknowledges their obedience. In verse 18, it says, "Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, because you have obeyed the command of Jonadab your father, kept all his commands and done according to all that he commanded you." What does God say after that? Does he reprimand them? Does he rebuke them for being like Pharisees, for being self-righteous, for thinking they're better than everybody else? Does he rebuke them because you're adding to the law? You're doing things that God's law didn't say to do. No, that's right. No, he doesn't say that. Jonadab was able to see the corruption around him as well as God's punishment. He was able to conclude that our family is going to be different than this. But imagine being the Rechabites in this situation. Like imagine we're being an Israelite even. And you're like, I want to follow God. I want to do the things that God has done. And you're looking around for good examples of that. Are you going to go to the pagans? Well, certainly not. Can you go to God's people at this time? No. Jonadab looks around and he sees, I can't even go to them. Are our eyes as open as his? Are we willing to go beyond just whatever the church fad is, or whatever the accepted church practices or something like that, based on worldly standards? If Jonadab could see that, we need to be able to consider, or are we satisfied with just being among the fairly good church-going Christian people who at least aren't as bad as those other people over there? Or are we striving for something a little better, a little stronger than that? So no, the Rechabites aren't reprimanded by God. Actually, as a result, they are praised by God. Look at what's said of them in verse 19. "Therefore, thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, Jonadab, the son of Rechab, shall not lack a man to stand before me always." Fathers and mothers, are we establishing family traditions and values that go beyond, well, do I really have to do this? For the sake of building a faith that is passed down to generations, is that what we're aiming for? I mean, the Rechabites are commended by God for doing this. Now, God doesn't then take these traditions and say, yeah, let's throw them into the Ten Commandments or anything like that. No, but he does praise them, because it came out of a heart of faith that wanted to serve God. And again, look at what is said to the Rechabites. "They shall not lack a man to stand before me always." Do you want that said of your family? Do you want that said of your children and your grandchildren, that there is always going to be a member of your family standing before God? Will God commend the Merkel family for their traditions and doing things that maybe they didn't necessarily have to do? But then they'll say of my children and my grandchildren, "There shall not lack a Merkel to stand before me always." Can they say that about us? Unfortunately, I have heard of, I have seen, and I have even participated in the shaming of people, even people in the church, for having godly but culturally weird traditions. May we not do that. I'm embarrassed that I have shamed other people for doing things that are a little weird or strange, but they're doing it for the sake of God, for the sake of worshiping God. God is calling the people of Judah to recognize these culturally weird practices, but adopt the godly attitude that produced them. Are we willing? Are we looking out and seeing that? And here's what's so wonderful. If you go back to the timeline here, it just continues even further. You see the Rechabites again, but in Nehemiah chapter 3, and now they're serving another official role, and they're working on rebuilding the walls there. They are still aiding and helping God's people. This tradition of man has lasted so much that they are this wonderful aid and support. What a legacy they have left. Are we looking to do the same? Yes, let us be more like the Rechabites by assessing the influences and potential fate of our culture, even in the church. We must be willing to look at the trajectory of where other things are going and begin to make rules within our family, maybe our family here at Oak Mountain, or maybe just our own personal family. But we need to be willing to make these by assessing what's going on and putting ourselves on a trajectory that's always going to have children that stands before God. And we do that by setting family priorities, by emphasizing godly principles over wealth and pleasure, by not chasing after a dollar or encouraging our kids, hey, you need to get a job that makes the most money, or you need to get a job that goes and does this thing over here. No, we are establishing a faith that can be passed down from generation to generation because these godly principles are emphasized over the other. And we establish permanent family traditions or practices, even if it, or I write up there, or because it separates us from common worldly practices. I know some have chosen to homeschool their kids. And you've chosen to do that. I know some have chosen to do that because they see this as part of their responsibility as parents. God has given them these children and they're going to do this to the best of their ability, and they want to help keep their children away from the worldly practices that can be found in other places. And I commend parents for doing that. And I know some people have put their kids in public schools in an effort to show kids, hey, here's the sad reality of some things that you're going to see. Here's how some people act, but here's how you can rise above that. And here's how you can be a light set on a hill for those people. And I commend parents for doing that. Some have chosen to refrain and really pump the brakes on culturally accepted fanaticism of sports in America. Or, let's be real, of college football in Alabama, right? Now, I love sports. Y'all know that. But I commend parents who have not made that an obsession to be passed down from generation to generation to generation. I mean, how many of us are Alabama, Auburn, or Georgia fans because your parents were, and their parents were, and their parents were, and their parents? I mean, how many of us? I mean, that describes a lot of us. Is that what we're emphasizing in our actions, or are we passing down a faith that is maintained and fostered and cared for and loved from generation to generation? I know some have chosen to prohibit any kind of social media for their family, not just for the kids, but for all of us. And I commend families for doing that. Some have chosen to read the Bible with their kids every morning or every night. They try to sing with them every chance that they get, whether it's inconvenient or not, whether they're on the road, whether it's late, whether it's after a ball game or whatever it is, you've established this is what we're going to do. I've even met some people who practice and observe the Sabbath. Not because they're suggesting that you have to be a Christian or this is the only way to be a Christian or something like that, but they see this as a practice that's helpful and that would be good for their family to pause, consider the things that God has given us and not rely on those worldly things. But for today, here's what we're going to do. And I commend people for doing that. We need to make family traditions that can be passed down so that we are preserving a faith that is founded upon God, not for our own prideful reasons or anything like that. You don't see that in the Rechabites. But it's because we are aiming for generations of service. We're not just looking out for ourselves, but we are trying to establish traditions that help direct the paths of generations to come. How are we doing with that? Look, we've seen people show extreme dedication to different things in life. And the reason behind that, the reason why people get so obsessive over some things, is because there's passion involved, right? They trust that this is the way to go. This is what I need to be doing. Let me suggest, if we truly believe that Jesus is the Christ, and we truly believe that he was sent to proclaim salvation to us, and if we trust that he bore our sins on the cross so that we might live in faithfulness to him, if we really believe those things, then whatever dedication is needed, may we drop everything else, set our own parameters so that we may obey that to the best of our ability. Because unlike these things that people show extreme dedication to, the payoff for dedication to God, both in this life, but especially in the life to come, as Paul mentions in 1 Timothy 4, is far greater than anything else. Renew that dedication tonight. If you are a Christian, but you know that you have fallen more into the line of Israelites than that of the Rechabites, you can align yourself with God. Pray to God. Ask for forgiveness. Start establishing, these are the things that I'm going to start doing. Or if you believe, you've come to believe and wish to put your faith in Jesus, your absolute dedication to him, you can begin that walk. You can trust in God, that God is faithful, and believe that you are on a path that ends in salvation with him, and that you will stand before God. If you have any need of either one of these invitations, please come up now while we stand and while we sing.